what General Wagon called the Battle of France is over. I expect that the Battle of Britain is about to begin. Upon this battle depends the survival of Christian civilization.
Hello, I'm Pam Rhodes, and you're listening to When We Prayed in World War II, a podcast from the Eternal Wall of Answered Prayer, produced by Premier. In this series, we're looking at the history of World War II through the lens of prayer, using as our guide the seven national days of prayer called by King George VI during the conflict. We'll hear audio and historical accounts from the time, alongside memories of answered prayers, miraculous escapes or unexplained events at home and abroad.
Dying in an aircraft was one thing, because they were in flames and he had to get out very quickly. Then there's the danger of the parachute jump and the fall, but possibly the most dangerous part of it was landing in the water. So he survived all three. Some people would call them lucky, but I think he had a sense of the providence of God.
After the miraculous Dunkirk evacuation, a day of thanksgiving was held in Westminster Abbey to celebrate the Allied troops being saved from annihilation. But there was little time to pause and reflect as the war in Europe raged on. During that summer, Paris fell under Nazi control, which was now overwhelming Europe's mainland. On the 18th of June, France's General de Gaulle, in exile in England, broadcast a radio message to his people, urging them to resist German rule.
Vive la France, libre, dans l'honneur et dans l'indépendance.
That same day, in another of his storied speeches, Churchill spoke of the heroic resistance by the French against heavy odds, but warned Parliament to be on guard.
What General Wagon called the Battle of France is over. I expect that the Battle of Britain is about to begin. Upon this battle depends the survival of Christian civilization. Upon it depends our own British life and the long continuity of our institutions and our empire. The whole fury and might of the enemy must very soon be turned on us. Hitler knows that he will have to break us in this island or lose the war. If we can stand up to him, all Europe may be free, and the life of the world may move forward into broad, sunlit uplands. But if we fail, then the whole world, including the United States, will sink into the abyss of a new dark age.
America, though a strategic supporter of the Allies, supplying vital munitions, had not yet entered the war themselves. And Churchill, ever the strategist, used his speech to send a message to Washington too.
Let us therefore brace ourselves to our duties. That if the British Empire and its Commonwealth last for 1,000 years, men will still say, this was their finest hour.
My father joined up in the RAF in 38. He only joined the Battle of Britain in September 1940 at Hawkinge near Folkestone, the sharpest end of the planes coming over from France.
The Reverend Paul Perkin and his wife Christine led a church plant in London for 30 years before moving to a parish in Kent close to where Paul's father, Flight Lieutenant Jack Perkin, was stationed during the Battle of Britain.
He was passionately concerned to defend our islands and to join what turned out to be the very few flying in the skies to repel the invasion.
For some reason, after so nearly annihilating the Allied forces at Dunkirk, Hitler chose not to follow them across the water to Britain. If he had, it could have been disastrous for the Allies, who'd escaped Hitler's clutches with only their lives, leaving nearly all their weaponry in France. Churchill's speech about fighting them on our beaches was partly calling Hitler's bluff. But it worked.
It was a miracle that Hitler didn't follow up his victory in Dunkirk with an immediate invasion.
The Reverend Dr. Victor Pierce was a theologian and scientist who experienced both the world wars. He was rector of a large Anglican parish and documented the history of the war, including the days of prayer. Let's listen to what he wrote about the summer of 1940.
At this time, the War Cabinet sought to inform clergy in Britain of the serious situation, while at the same time providing a positive message of hope and encouragement. The first of a series of letters from Duff Cooper at the Ministry of Information was circulated on the 21st of June 1940, advising what Hitler was seeking to do that autumn, and to prepare the congregations to fight side by side for the fields and villages and cities that we love.
The Battle of Britain, known in Germany as the Battle for Britain, was fought in the air, and it began a few weeks later with the first Luftwaffe attack on the 10th of July. The RAF was outnumbered and outgunned, so a month into the battle, the King called his people to another National Day of Prayer. Dr. Pierce describes the response.
That first day of prayer was followed up by two more within 5 months. So within 5 months, we had three national days of prayer, not called by the church, but called by the King and Parliament. But did the nation respond as a nation? They did. Hardly anybody stayed away. The churches and halls were crammed full, and overflows outside were sometimes bigger than the crush inside.
In one town, Dr. Pierce writes, they didn't even wait for the National Day of Prayer. One morning in July, he recorded that a humble greengrocer got his fellow shopkeepers to cease trading for an hour so that everyone could stop and pray. What's more, the local Traders Association approved it.
The second day of prayer was held on Sunday, August the 11th, 1940. This was a national youth call to prayer. The King had called all the young people to pray. I was walking past a large area of tennis courts on the way to church. The tennis courts were deserted, except for a perplexed young man holding a tennis racket. He was completely alone. "Where have they all gone?" he exclaimed. "They are all in church praying for national deliverance," I said. "Why don't you go?" "I can't believe this. My pals have never gone to church, even once in their lives."
Young people were very invested in the war effort. Many signed up to serve as soon as they were old enough to do so.
He was only 18 when he joined up. And my mother was in the WAFs. She was 2 years younger than he. So in 1940, she was still only 18. Very, very young. She knew many of his very close friends who also died.
Hitler's goal, as Churchill had predicted, was to take out the RAF. Once he'd established air supremacy, he planned to launch Operation Sea Lion, an attack by land and sea, which he imagined would rapidly result in capitulation by Churchill and German domination of Britain, either through armistice or surrender. After meeting with his military leaders, Hitler decided that a week or two should do it. He was convinced that in a game of brinkmanship, Churchill could easily be won over once the threat of a German invasion was imminent. He was wrong. The Battle of Britain would be the Nazis' first major defeat and mark another major turning point in the war that was still not yet a year old. The Luftwaffe's planes were believed to outnumber the RAF by 4-1. But as Churchill and Air Chief Marshal Dowding, the head of the RAF, set about strategising how to maintain Britain's defence, they had two secret weapons in their favour, radar and fighter command. When used together, it created a brilliant command and control network, which meant that the few pilots Britain did have could be deployed with maximum effect and with a serious advantage in defence. The Reverend Paul Perkins' mother, Colleen, worked at Fighter Command.
That's how they met, because in Folkestone she was stationed. She was a plotter. They pushed the squadrons out over the channel and back in.
The command centres relied on information from radar towers. These days, it's easy to forget how cutting-edge radar technology was at the time. Never before could incoming planes be detected before they were seen or heard. Tiny blips on the radar screens gave the RAF vital extra seconds in which to scramble and intercept them. The difference was often between life and death. In one conversation featured in a movie about the Battle of Britain, which was approved by Hugh Dadding himself, a government minister asked the Air Marshal for an update to give the cabinet. "So, I'm to tell them you're praying to God and trusting radar, is that it?" he says. "More like the other way round," replies Dowding. "I'm trusting God and praying for radar." Plotters like Paul Perkins' mother Colleen were a vital link in the chain of command as RAF commanders made split-second decisions.
Listening to the instructions, she would push him out across the channel and hope that she was pulling him back home again afterwards. She couldn't identify individual planes, it was squadrons.
The pilots responded like modern-day firefighters to a 999 call. Fighter Command was, if you like, the call centre. It was a dramatic start to romance for Flight Lieutenant Perkin and his future wife, Colleen. The Dowding system became so efficient that a squadron could be airborne within 90 seconds to meet the oncoming planes. For the pilots especially, it was a rarefied existence. Many had only been flying for a few months and were still relatively new to the sensation. Geoffrey Wellham signed up on a short service commission with the Royal Air Force in August 1939. His first solo flight was on the 1st of September, aged 18. 2 days later, Britain was at war. Wellham lived into his 90s and described the experience of learning to fly in his book, First Light.
"It was an exhilaration that I cannot recall ever having felt before. It was like one of those wonderful dreams, a Peter Pan sort of dream. There is no longer any doubt that some omniscient force understands what life is all about. There are times when the feeling of being near to an unknown presence is strong and real and comforting."
First Light was later made into a BBC documentary. But the life and work of a pilot was hard too, and psychologically challenging. Of the numerous German fighters which escorted the bombers, Wellham wrote,
"God, is there no end to them? The sun glints on their wings and bellies as they roll like trout in a stream, streaking over smooth round pebbles. Trout streams, water meadows, waders, fast-flowing water, the pretty barmaid at the inn. Dear Jesus, why this?"
Life was very temporary. You were almost living out of a suitcase. A lot of the time. I mean, this must be unique in the history of warfare. There's that you were flying an enemy against an enemy in the skies, but in the evening going off to the pub in a village in England, living this completely contradictory existence must have been part of the reason why so many found it psychologically traumatising.
The Reverend Perkin believes his father's easygoing temperament, coupled with a quiet, private faith, helped him cope.
He carried a New Testament in his breast pocket when he was flying, and I think it was more than just a talisman. I remember him saying that whenever he was involved in a dogfight, he always prayed that the aircraft would be shot down, but that the pilot would survive.
Perhaps without knowing it, Flight Lieutenant Perkin was also praying for himself.
He was shot down in the channel and parachuted almost down onto a fishing boat who leaned over the side and hauled him out of the water. It was event after event like that that gave him this tremendous sense of not luck, but of God's providence. I think one of the things my father was very conscious of was that it's an enigma, a great puzzle as to why some seem to have the kind of following of God's protection and help and blessing and even answers to the prayers, and others don't. And I don't think we have a neat answer to that. God is God, and his sovereign will is not necessarily for us to fully understand. But nevertheless, he revealed, and through Jesus in particular, that we are to pray and we are to ask. The more that we pray, maybe the more that we're likely to see the miraculous answers. And I think many Christians would testify to that.
King George announced Sunday, the 8th of September, would be the nation's third day of prayer, planned to commemorate a whole year since the start of the war. Perhaps it was a coincidence, but as the day approached, whether out of impatience, frustration, or fear of what might happen when Britain prayed, Hitler once again changed his mind. Once again, it was sudden, and once again, it was at a critical moment that some say defied military sense. On Friday, the 6th of September, 1940, he announced a new tactic. He ordered the Luftwaffe to turn their sights towards England's cities. The Battle of Britain was ending. The Battle of London had begun. The German systematic bombing campaign on the capital continued for 56 of the next 57 days and nights. It was the start of the Blitz. And though the suffering was awful, Britain was able, almost miraculously, to snatch victory from the jaws of defeat. Runways and planes were in desperate need of repair, and both were essential to be able to mount any form of defence against the German attack. Just as the RAF seemed to have nothing left, Hitler's sudden decision to divert attention away from the airfields gave the Allied Air Force a vital opportunity to replenish their resources. Halfway through the battle, shortly after that second day of prayer, the Prime Minister was passing through Uxbridge outside London and stopped off at the underground bunker which served as the headquarters for No. 11 Group, from where Air Vice Marshal Park was directing operations. As Churchill watched around 100 incoming German planes being plotted on the map and squadron after squadron being sent up in response, he asked Park about reserves. The Vice Marshal looked grave and replied, "There are none." General Ismay, who was travelling with the Prime Minister, wrote later that Churchill couldn't speak as he left the bunker. He was so moved by what he'd witnessed. The following week, he spoke these time-honoured words in Parliament.
"The gratitude of every home in our island goes out to the British airmen who, undaunted by odds, unwearied in their constant challenge and mortal danger, are turning the tide of the world war by their prowess and by their devotion. Never in the field of human conflict was so much owed by so many to so few."
And that is true. They were so few, and we owe them a great deal. But the Battle of Britain was also won by the many, the hundreds and thousands of workers, volunteers, and servicemen and women in Britain who did what they could using whatever skills they had. Whether monitoring the skies from a lonely observation post on the south coast with nothing but a telephone and a telescope for company, or working long hours in the old car factories to get fighter planes flying again, or as a plotter moving chess pieces on a map to help commanders know precisely when and where to send up reinforcements. In some cases, their task was simply to pray. Each person who brought what they could played a part in the story, which ended in a narrow but crucial victory. In the next episode, we'll look at what happened during the Blitz and some of the prayers that were prayed then. But no tribute to the Battle of Britain would be complete without a mention of John Gillespie Maggi's poem, High Flight, known as the Pilot's Poem. Maggi was a young American pilot who volunteered for the Royal Canadian Air Force in 1940, more than a year before his own country entered the war. He flew in the Battle of Britain and survived, but was sadly killed in a plane crash in 1941, aged just 19. His family lived in Washington, D.C. His father happened to be the assistant minister at St. John's Church, opposite the White House, and he shared the poem his son had sent home just months earlier with reporters. The poem is now housed at the Library of Congress and was part of an exhibition there called Poems of Faith and Freedom, and was even taken to the moon on one of the Apollo missions. It describes a perspective that only pilots, astronauts, and maybe angels get to see. Oh, I have slipped the surly bonds of earth and danced the skies on laughter-silvered wings. Sunward I've climbed and joined the tumbling mirth of sun-split clouds and done 100 things you've not dreamed of, wheeled and soared and swung high in the sunlit silence. Hovering there, I've chased the shouting wind along and flung my eager craft through footless halls of air. Up, up the long, delirious, burning blue, I've topped the windswept heights with easy grace where never lark nor ever eagle flew. And while, with silent lifting mind, I've trod the high, untrespassed sanctity of space, put out my hand and touched the face of God. The When We Prayed podcast by the Eternal Wall of Answered Prayer is produced by Premier. The series producer is Ross Mayfield, sound engineer is Bradley Howard, and the presenter is me, Pam Rhodes. You can like, share and review this podcast. And if you hit the subscribe button and turn on notifications, you'll receive an update when more episodes become available. To find out more about the Eternal Wall or to share your story of answered prayer, go to eternalwall.org.uk or see the information in the show notes. Thank you for listening and see you again next time.